Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Thanks for joining me on the Ask a Theologian podcast. My name is Dave, and I'm the host of this podcast. On Ask a Theologian, I talk with theologians about their work, about their theology, and we work together to try to bridge the gap between theological thinking and practical living. So if you enjoy this podcast, if you're getting some insights out of it, if it's helping you in any way, I'd love to have you give us a review on or wherever you listen to your podcasts. That would be great. We just would really appreciate it. On today's show, I had the privilege of sitting down with Dr. Daniel Costello. Dr. Daniel Costello is a professor at Duke University, originally from Mexico. He brings his Hispanic perspective into the world of theology. And we had the opportunity to talk about a lot of things, but we were talking about Pentecostalism and kind of some of its mystic beginnings and holiness and how that's all connected to Pentecostal perspective on life and theology. I know I had a great time, and I'm pretty sure that you will enjoy it as well. So why don't you sit back and enjoy this as you listen to this episode of Ask a Theologian. Be good. Yeah, so what we've been doing this year is taking the church through systematic theology, I guess is the bottom line. So we've taken 8 topics. We've gone through 5, and we're headed into the last 3 this fall, which are going to be a lot of fun. You know, we're doing ecclesiology, and then we're doing hamartiology. So maybe we'll throw in a little theodicy in that, and if I'm saying that correctly, I'm not sure.
I typically say theodicy.
Theodicy. All right. Well, that would probably be the better way to say it. And then we're going to do soteriology. End up with that. So it's been an interesting thing, particularly because as we came out of COVID, sort of felt like as a pastor that a little bit that failed people and they hadn't had a strong enough foundation to be able to make some of the decisions they needed to make in isolation, and said, okay, let's go back and let's put foundations in so people can figure out how to think.
Oh, that's
fun. So we've tried hard to build a church that people don't just recite what I tell them, but question it and ask and think about it. And but as you probably know, that's a bit challenging.
Well, I applaud you for doing it, though, because it's an investment in people to find their agency in all of this, right?
Yeah. So that's a big thing. But I've been having fun. I'm having fun with it as well. Now, your background, although you're at Duke, and if I understand correctly, you're licensed or ordained with, is it the United Methodist or Free Methodist?
Free Methodist Church.
Free Methodist. Uh-huh. Two different groups.
They are, but they're related. They have a common history up until the middle part of the 19th century. Yeah. Free Methodism emerged as a renewal movement in the midst of questions related to capitalism and slavery and other things.
Mm-hmm. And paying for pews.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. But you grew up in a Pentecostal environment.
I did.
And if I remember right, your dad is Guatemalan?
Mexican.
Oh, Mexican. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then your mom is American or Southern states.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, they met in college, and my dad was able to get a scholarship from a denominational agency. And so my dad went to Tennessee and met my mother.
Oh, sure.
God. Okay. That's right. Yeah, I was in college back then. And they married, went back to Mexico. I was born in Mexico, raised in Mexico for a few years.
What part of Mexico were you from?
I was born in Guadalajara, but I was mostly raised in Hermosillo, which is south of the Arizona border.
Yeah, I know where Hermosillo is. In fact, I just was having a conversation just 2 nights ago with a fellow from there whose son was doing an exchange here, and he was up to pick him up. And
oh, nice.
So we had a long conversation.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that denomination, Church of God, Cleveland, it's a Wesleyan Pentecostal denomination. As I learned about my Pentecostal identity, I also learned about Wesleyan roots. I see those two traditions working hand in hand just based on my own experience.
Sure. Sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether this is true or not, but it seems to me that many of the Pentecostal theological voices that I hear seem to have come out of, well, not necessarily Lee University, but maybe out of Church of God Seminary, a Pentecostal seminary.
Yeah.
A lot of them. In fact, this morning I was listening to Mark Sharona, and, you know, he was on a podcast and started listing off a list of names of people, you know, Ken Archer, Chris Green, Robbie Waddell. I think you could throw in Melissa Archer in there too. Yeah, but yeah, I'm surprised you didn't say anything about John Christopher Thomas. But
yeah, it was. So I went there for my seminary degree. The season of the early 90s was one in which Pentecostal scholarship really came into its own. And many of those folks were at the cutting edge of that.
Yeah.
On the basis of their scholarship and their networks. They established what some people call a Cleveland School of Pentecostal Studies. And I'm certainly a product of that and proud of it. They really did some good pioneering work.
Certainly had a real influence on Pentecostal scholarship. Mm-hmm. When I was in Bible college, and that was the mid-80s or early 80s, I didn't know at the time, but one of my professors was Roger Strongstad.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, it's funny. It took 40 years till I realized that he had had the influence he had on scholarship. Mm. I was sitting in a systematic theology class and his name came up and I was just shocked. I was surprised.
Yeah.
At least from my end, leads a lot to the realization how low a view of theological education our denomination or Pentecostalism in general, I think, had for quite some time. And that's changing now. I'm grateful for that. Now, you've written quite a bit. I think last count must be around 10 books that you've written, monographs, but there's a few other chapters and things like that. Mm-hmm. One of the books that really caught my attention was Pentecostalism as a, the connection to Christian mysticism.
Yes.
So can you, what are we talking about when we say Christian mystical tradition?
If one looks at the history of the Christian church, one notices that there are emphases and figures and movements that stress things like transformation, encounter.
Right.
It's not that there are anti-rational themes, but they go deeper than reason at some level. So the famous Pascal notion, the heart has its reasons kind of idea. And Pascal would be considered possibly a mystic too. And so there's this tradition of figures who, the way that they reason and the way that they work through the Christian faith, it just doesn't sit at the level of the linguistic or discursive point of view or perspective. But we're talking about matters of the heart, matters of the spirit that have real consequences for how people envision or think about the faith. And that's a way of thinking about mysticism. Okay. I use the language in the book mystical tradition rather than mysticism, because mysticism has always had a challenge in terms of defining it. And I stress the language of tradition as a mystical tradition to highlight that it's that Pentecostalism, if it's understood as a form of Christian mysticism, it's part of a tradition of other figures and other movements. And you see that when you look at Pentecostals who take seriously the history of the church and who are the figures that they gravitate to. There are oftentimes folks like certain writings of Augustine or maybe some patristic sources, medieval sources, not necessarily modern ones, but those figures who would stress that knowing God is a matter of the heart. And when you pray to God, God is present and you can encounter God and be changed by that. So those are some of the themes that in my mind are associated with Christian mysticism. And it's important because I think that we're at a point now in Western intellectual history in which we are seeing that the over-reliance on certain accounts of reason has led to some exposures of limits and abuses. Mm. And people oftentimes talk about they want authenticity and seriousness.
Yeah.
And when a person can say something to the effect, I believe God and God spoke to me and I encountered God and God makes a difference for my life.
Right.
Those are weighty theological and specifically epistemological claims. But much of Western epistemology in the last 300-400 years, it can't accommodate it. What mysticism can. And so it's a way of connecting Pentecostalism to different currents in Christianity so as to stress that it's not something totally new. That it's standing within a tradition of reflection and thought, but also the fact that it comes about in the time that it does means that it makes a certain contribution. And that's what I would
think. So would that require us to think about Pentecostalism in general as something? When I was in college and in ministry, it was lots of talk about our Pentecostal distinctives.
Yeah.
Basically, we're just like Baptists, we're just like evangelical, but we've got some Pentecostal distinctives, but everything else is the same. But I hear you saying that there's maybe that's not quite the best way to look at it.
I think there are limits to that approach. Certainly, all the folks that are going to be cited are Christians. And so there's a heritage of Christian identity that those groups share. At the same time, I think an argument can be made that there are, within that heading of Christianity, there are multiple kinds of Christianities, plural.
Sure.
And that makes people nervous, but there are different ways to interpret the gospel, and there are different ways to live out the gospel. And it's important to note those differences. When you look at Pentecostalism and some of the things that it highlights, it's not just a question of, oh, we have a different belief in this or that view or doctrine. It oftentimes comes down to, we just have a different way of approaching Christianity. And as a result of that, we have a different way of engaging the world.
And so it's more significant than just, oh, we've got a couple of beliefs that are different. We're looking at this whole thing differently.
Yes, I think so. And sometimes it's hard for people to see who are inside of the movement. Sometimes it's hard for people to see who are outside the movement. But thinking about just worldview matters, right? In terms of what's wrong? What difference can we make? What's God's place in this? What's God's relationship to the world? How do we fit? Those are where some of those major differences come through. And as a result, I think it's a reduction of Pentecostal identity to say that it's just strictly related to a couple of different doctrinal names. It's really bigger than that. Now, it could be that some people live into it that way, that it's just those small things. But in the fullness of what it can be, it is a distinctive approach that marks one and many, well, I would say, these depth registers of what it means to be human, what it means to participate in the world, how a person places themselves in the world.
So would, you know, I'm just thinking through some of the things that I would have encountered in early ministry or growing up in, I grew up in Pentecostal church as well. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that education, well, that'll ruin your faith. Is that kind of is that fit into that same kind of worldview?
If education is understood as a way of, well, let's put it this way. It matters what account of rationality is at work when somebody attempts to analyze something or to consider something.
Right.
So I'll just take the case of anthropology, for instance. You have different schools of anthropology, and some will say things like, well, we can explain that phenomenon, or we can make sense of that phenomenon because it's based on this and this and this.
Sure.
That's a very modern way of approaching anthropology, in which the person who's anthropologizing knows better than the subject that they are considering.
Right.
Okay, I know you better than yourself because I can say you're doing this and this because you have this impulse biologically or because you were shaped culturally or so forth. But then there's another school of, or schools of anthropology that suggest, I'm just going to take you on your own terms and hear you out. And it's not my role to try to explain away your perspectives, but there is some legitimacy or integrity to what you have to say. And that's going to stand on its own. So I can see why Pentecostals sometimes had a negative perspective on education. If education had at its aim explaining away Christian convictions or explain away what the Pentecostal approach to things was, that's very much a modern or modernist approach to knowledge. But where we are now in a more postmodern context, I think if Pentecostals are given space at the table to be able to share their perspectives, and also, this is critical too, and be willing to hear others around that same table, education can be a very positive thing, right? So I think it comes down to certain Pentecostals having bad experiences with higher education. They have horror stories in which people had a very beautiful faith, but maybe a little simplistic faith. And then they go to seminary, have all these questions, like historical critical methodologies of the Bible, and just blows everything up. And then they denounce everything and they think, oh, that's what education will do to you. Well, not only certain kinds of education. And plus, I think the best way to help people, and this is why I appreciate a podcast like this, to help people navigate a world full of questions and contradictions, is to face them head on. And one's faith can be built and strengthened through engagement with otherness rather than shying away from it. So I think it just depends upon how a person approaches education and what's dominant in a particular situation is in terms of what counts as education.
I'm really fascinated with how you've said that Pentecostalism really just comes at the whole thing differently, you know, and therefore tying it into the Christian mystical tradition. I'm thinking like St. John of the Cross with Teresa of Avila, you know, those kind of things. But just even in interpreting the Bible, then you mentioned historical textual criticism, then we have a whole nother way of looking at the Bible. So now we have a spiritual reading.
Sure. And those are tied, right? I think the great mystical voices of the Christian tradition approach scripture in these ways with spiritual readings, you know, that there's different senses of scripture, different ways of approaching them. In modernity, oftentimes the hermeneutical or the interpretive process flattened the possibilities of what a text could mean by saying, oh, well, you have to look at what the author thought and the context of it, of the writing, and that secures the meaning of the text as you look at it as a historical point of view. But from more ancient forms of reading, you can ask the question, well, if this text is inspired by God and God led it to become what it is to help us, God's voice can be heard through it. And what's God saying to us in this text? That's a mystical way of approaching the biblical text. And it's an ancient way. It's a good way. It's not the only way, but it's a very helpful way. And I think Pentecostals would find a lot of resonance with that approach because, yes, if this is a text that God inspired and God illuminates for our benefit, for our sanctification today, then we can look at it from the perspective historically, but also literarily and also spiritually.
So there's more to it. So, you know, Gordon Fee's, I think it's, you know, How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth, you know, a text cannot mean something that it couldn't have meant to the original hearers is really a, would be a non-Pentecostal approach to that.
Well, I mean,
considering Gordon Fee, you know, so.
With all respect to Gordon Fee, I mean, that's not a typical Pentecostal response. Now, you need all these different approaches to scripture to keep each other honest, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it can't just be whatever I want it to be. It means something on its own. God has something to say through it. Sure. And how do I discern what God's saying through it? It's not just myself in my room by myself, but in the community with the church and with others. And so, for me, it's looking at a complementary vision of different approaches. And Gordon Fee's, without the strong delimitation, but there is something to be said. It means something in its context.
Yeah, of course.
This word had connotations that maybe I'm not even aware of until I do the work of exegesis to find out what the words mean. And this text can also be something that God uses to speak to me today in a way that's different than maybe what, you know, Paul or Peter intended, right? And that's the beauty of it. It's not just Paul's words. It's God's word through Paul or through Peter.
So that would be the mystical connection in there. Now, you also written a bit on theodicy, which is, you know, well, maybe define that for me first before I really plunge in.
Well, it can have a very particular definition or it can have a very broad definition. A very particular definition would be, how do you reconcile certain attributes of God or qualities of God, such as that God is good and or that God is all powerful? How can you reconcile that depiction of God with all the evil and suffering that's in the world?
Right.
And so theodicy etymologically comes from the root theos, God, and then dike, which has it, is connected to the language of dikaiosune, which is righteousness in Greek. So how can God be in the right? Is that etymologically what's at play in theology? How can God be in the right or be justified? in light of all that the world is, all its suffering, right, all its pain, and so forth. And I say it has a very particular definition because Wilhelm Leibniz made this word famous through some of his writings. People have been doing it before and have done it after, but he's very famous with that, for making that word popular. And I just want to stress that in that context, there were so many advances happening in mathematics in explaining how the world works. Right. When you think about how it would affect a culture's imagination when you can calculate how long it takes for something to fall to the ground, right? And you have a formula for it. Yep. There was a time before people could do that, and now there's a time where people can define precisely how long something takes to fall to the ground, or how long it takes for us to circle around the sun. So mathematics is understood in this world as truth.
Right.
It doesn't matter if you're from one country or another, you can boil everything down to a proposition or to a formula, and it works well with gravity. It works well with astronomy. Why wouldn't it work well with theology?
Right. So we abandon our Greek philosophical basis for theology and grab a hold of science.
Well, I think so, because science is just uncovering so many. I think, people oftentimes make decisions based on biases or superstitions or traditions. And here you have something that's concrete that you can make a case for. And so I try to have some sympathy for people during this era because, it would really make you rethink everything if mathematics had that new sense of applicability to the world.
Right.
But humans are humans, and they don't make sense half the time. And you can't reduce human actions or human thinking to—
You must be a pastor's kid. Yeah.
That's right. So the idea that you could apply math or geometric reasoning, because that's a syllogism that's oftentimes sustained in theodicy. If God is this, and then there's this, ergo, therefore, blank. You assume that there's a resolution coming out of that, those propositions. And that's not how the world works. That's not how humans work. But a lot of people thought that they could operate that way. So that's a very technical, particular definition of theodicy. When I think about theodicy, I think the larger pastoral questions, just how to navigate this space of living as fallen creatures who have a sense of beauty and a sense of eternity built in by that very God in their lives. And they're just yearning for a sense of why did these things happen? And how can my faith make sense of this? Oftentimes people fall back to that very specific definition and say, if there's evil in the world, if there's suffering in the world, then God can't be good, or God can't be all powerful. And the Christian gospel is about hope, right?
Right.
So I tend to think of theodicy in more generally as a set of concerns that involve pastoral ones. And that's why I titled the book that I did Theological Theodicy. Because I wanted to stress that it's not just theodicy of any kind, but it's one that stresses that the God of Christian confession is the one who has created us, who sustains us, and the one to whom we are moving and toward eternity.
So in some ways, asking the question, if God's really good, why is there evil in the world?
Really? Yes, we are. Because the fact that we can ask the question why there's evil presumes that we have some sense of good. And where do we get that sense of good from?
Right.
So when we are disturbed, or when we are shocked or scandalized by how awful the world is, that presumes that we are standing on some sense of what righteousness and goodness. And so how can you make a case for that? Right. Now, one of the very challenging things to do here is that you don't want to use Christian theology as a way of explaining away things or invalidating people's pain.
Right.
And sadly, I say this as a theologian, oftentimes people do use theology that way. People say, well, why did God allow this? Or what's going on here? Instead of hearing a cry of a person who has lost someone or who is hurting, and attending to that cry as the psalmist would, Oftentimes we come back, oh, because God, you know, needed that person. Oh, God has a plan and everything happens for a reason.
Right.
And theology used the one of a very harsh way to say it is that theology can be weaponized as a way of, of putting people, delimiting them or invalidating where they are.
Not recognizing the humanity in humanity.
That's right.
Now you, I'm not sure if this, I did notice you have a, at least one book that's entirely Spanish. I didn't notice if there was an English equivalent, but the Spanish, the book that I noticed, you know, I didn't read it, I'll be honest, but I realize it's about suffering and, you know, God does bad things. And so, you know, here's, again, as Pentecostal, here's the conflict I think, you know, I see, and maybe you've partly answered it already, is we have, as Pentecostal, we have a theology of overcoming, but not so much a theology of suffering, because they're incongruent with a theology of healing. And so, you know, how do we wrestle those? You know, now we're mystic tradition, we're believing in healing, and yet we've got to accept the fact that it's a suffering, but doesn't that reduce our faith?
Sure. I wrote an article on this after I wrote the little volume, trying to attend to that dynamic, and I titled the article, What If Miracles Don't Happen?
Right.
And because you're right, there is this sense with overcoming and the expectation of miracles, and those are things that Pentecostals oftentimes really appreciate and hold dear, and they should, because when you have this sense of expectation that God is real, God is active, God is here, things can happen, that's wonderful, it's beautiful. And I think responsibly, if one is going to have that kind of perspective on things, one also has to have a complementary perspective. And if the miracle that's desired doesn't happen, or if the outcome doesn't play out the way that people want it to, that doesn't negate God's goodness and God's purposes and God's power, and it doesn't negate the person either who's sick or who's hurting, right? It doesn't mean that there's sin in their lives or that somehow they're not deserving. Or so that's
it seems like a cop-out, though, to say, well, you know, it just wasn't God's will.
Sure. I mean, it could be a cop out. But at the same time, I would argue that we have to be open to the fact that God's purposes and the way God moves are not always aligned with our desires. Right. Yeah. And the thing that can hold us grounded in that possibility is that Jesus walked the way of the cross. Jesus asked the question, can this cup pass? And it didn't. He went through the cross. He didn't avoid it. He wasn't spared it. He went through it. And when we are honest about our own lives, all of us are going to die. And most likely that death will involve suffering, and we will witness suffering of various kinds. And we have to reckon with the power and the shaping of those developments and not explain them away or deny them. That's another part too, is that I've ministered as a chaplain to various Pentecostals. Many of them, sadly, are in denial, you know, and it gets in the way of connecting with their loved ones before they pass, or it gets in the way of thinking about their legacy. And so it's, you don't want your theology to get in the way from being fully human.
Right.
So just trying to navigate those tensions is a really important process.
I think it's Leonard Sweet that says orthodoxy is paradoxy. So, you know, the idea of a theology of healing in the atonement is not inconsistent with having a theology of suffering. In fact, they're inseparable.
Yes. I think that's well said.
That's hard to take.
Theology is much more than just giving answers. Mm-hmm. And I worry sometimes as a theologian that people look to theologians or pastoral leaders for answers to their concerns. And it's not that there aren't answers, but that's not necessarily the best way to proceed for everything, right? I mean, how can you explain the death of a child, or how can you make sense of a tragedy like the wars that we're seeing and the conflicts we're seeing today? So, you know, it's not just about answers. It's about sustaining a life in community where we can support one another and face head on how awful this life can be and still be hopeful.
Yeah, brilliant. I think it's a great response. Now, you've also written, you know, just thinking, you've also written along the lines of holiness. And I think that would be certainly part of the Wesleyan tradition to some degree.
Sure.
William Seymour was a holiness preacher as much as anything. We've got, the problem with evil, the problem with sin, the problem with suffering. But then we also have this call to holiness. Mm-hmm. I'd love if you could just kind of speak into how the Pentecostal, you know, from a Pentecostal, how that Pentecostal experience, how that pulls us into holiness.
I think that the Pentecostal experience and the mystical experience can pull us into holiness by stressing that there are more things happening in a given moment than we realize or that we understand, right? When we think about holiness, sometimes people have the perception, oh, well, it's a world-defying perspective. You know, the world does certain things, the church does other things, and the church is holy, right, and the world is sinful. And so they think of holiness as something of a contrast.
Maybe we need to define holiness.
Well, that's what I'm moving to, because there are a lot of different understandings of holiness too. And that's not necessarily a bad definition, but it already sets up an us versus them approach. The world is this way and we are this way. And it just so happened we self-privilege and say, you know, we are holy and
we self-privilege.
We're pursuing the right paths and others need what we have. And we are the ones who can give it to them by teaching them and giving them different resources and so forth. But when you think about the holiness of God, right, because ultimately God is holy. And when we think of holiness, it has to be a God-shaped idea. Yeah. Right?
Be holy like I'm holy.
Leviticus 19 and 2 and other passages. So God is a source of holiness. So when you think about the righteousness of God, the goodness of God, the beauty of God, the love of God, all those are wrapped around this notion too of holiness. A sense of God's holiness is what the world needs. In the face of evil, we don't respond in kind. Right. In the face of suffering, we can support one another in love. And those are holy moments. And those are holy possibilities. So for me, I think of holiness as being caught up in a rapture of who God is and what God is like. And in being caught up in that, by the grace of God, being shaped by that, so that then as one engages the world and is shaped by God's character and as a vehicle of God's grace or an agent of God's grace, then people can see, oh, there is something to this life, or there is an alternative way of thinking, an alternative way of living, and it's good, it's beautiful,
right?
So I do think that those are all connected, as you say, because the world is hurting and the world is suffering, and many recognize that and they're looking for what's the alternative. And we as Christians are called to point them to God and to point them to God's promises, to God's acts in history, and for us to create the kind of spaces where that's possible, where we can witness to who God is and what God has done. So
just maybe wrapping up a little bit here. I appreciate your time. I want to value it. We live in a very polarized world, and I'm here in Canada, and I realize we're not dealing with all the same political issues, not in the same sense that you are where you are, but we're still polarized on everything and all the human rights issues, the sexuality, gender identity. I mean, Canada as a whole is a fairly progressive, I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not. And so we have this crazy world where we're asked to be holy. And yet it seems like everything is just so in our face. Can you give people some hope, some direction? How do we live our life out in that?
I don't want to diminish the importance of these hot button issues or these pressures that we're facing culturally and politically, because they shape so much of our discourse and they draw so much of our attention. I personally don't think that we can have a conversation about holiness starting with those kinds of matters, because they're already divisive. And if we pull in holiness, then it's going to lead possibly to one group is holy and one group is not.
Right.
And that would just feed into the polarization that we're trying to resist. Yeah. So I think another way of thinking about holiness is just to, again, I don't want to sound Pollyannish to say we can all get along and everything's fine. We just do these things. I understand there are complex matters all around, but there is something to be said for finding common ground.
Right.
And there is something to be said for us to engage in that work of finding common ground with some sense of humility. Right. You know, we worship a Christ, a Christ figure who, according to the Philippians hymn, gave up, right? Yeah. Emptied himself to be with us in solidarity. And I don't see a lot of that emptying in our discourse and in our engagement with one another. What I see oftentimes is people trying to one-up others or trying to take the moral high ground and marginalizing them or othering them. And I just, when you think of, again, that Christ hymn, Philippians 2, 5 through 11, and Paul, I believe, is really trying to attend to matters of Christian unity. That's such a dominant theme in Paul's letters, right?
Yes.
And if you look at that Philippians passage, you know, have the mind of Christ, which is what? To put yourself not first, right? To attend to the other, to live sacrificially. So if we approach things like our contemporary pressures that way, I think that does open up some possibilities for better understanding, more civility, which I think is crucial.
Seems to be a missing component of it at the moment.
Right. No, and again, oftentimes there's entitlement. I mean, entitlement goes in the face against a kenotic, self-emptying understanding of Philippians 5 through 11.
Yeah.
So I think it's just looking at some of those markers of what we have in our heritage and to allow those to question us and to stir us to a different approach, right? And a lot of this is also driven by fear and a sense of losing power and influence. And a lot of those concerns, a lot of those values are not very theological.
Right.
So just having those honest conversations about really what's at stake here, and is it our privilege? Is it our sense of understanding? If we really want something different, if we really want a different way than what we're experiencing, it takes a lot of hard work on both sides.
You just need to do the hard work.
Yeah,
just the hard work. Well, I think that's an encouraging summary of it, that if we really want it, we just got to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that hits more to the core of the issue, is maybe we don't want it as much as we say.
That's it. Yeah, we would rather be right to be in community or things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recently read Terry Crist's book, Loving Samaritans. I don't know if you've heard of it, but Terry says that we talk about the disadvantaged and everything else as we have to go minister to them. And he says, actually, we just go meet Jesus where he loves to live. Mm-hmm. And that's where they are. And I think we keep sending telegrams or whatever.
Sure, that's right.
Yeah. Listen, it's just been a great pleasure to have this conversation.
Yeah, likewise.
I'm especially blessed. And I appreciate you making time to meet with me. I know as a theologian and actively teaching in Duke Divinity, you've got lots of stuff on the go, even in the summer. And if I remember right, you were doing some teaching down in some Latin American seminaries for a while. I don't know if you're still doing that.
Not as much now, but yes, I had done some work in different countries. And it's part of my heritage. I'm trying to contribute in that way. These days, I'm in administration here at Duke Divinity, so it occupies most of my time.
Well, I will just make this comment to close, but I've done a lot of ministry in Cuba. And I have to say that in most of my travels there, what I would call the most spirit-filled Pentecostal group there are the Methodists.
Mm-hmm.
So then the traditional Pentecostal denominations. But man, we had some times with Methodists there, I'll tell you.
I've heard that.
It's remarkable.
It's one thing to have the label, but it's another thing to have the life.
And that's great.
It defies the labels, right?
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much.
No, thank you so much for the privilege of being with you and to have this chat. Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for joining us on today's episode of Ask a Theologian. If you're enjoying our show, it would be really helpful to us if you gave us a 5-star rating on whatever platform you use to consume your podcasts. And if you have time, a written review would be even better. But either way, we hope you are enjoying the podcast. And if you've got questions, please send your questions. Who knows, maybe I'll be able to feature your question on a future episode of Ask a Theologian. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.